Welcome to Monocle's food and drink program, The Menu. I am Markus Hippi. In the next 30 minutes, Sweden's culinary star Magnus Nilsson will join me to reflect the story of his restaurant Feviken and why it had to close its doors.
I've never been of the persuasion that you should go out looking specifically for a certain type of inspiration. I don't think that that's how creativity actually works. And when you do that, it's more something that resembles problem solving to me.
Also ahead, Swiss wine guru Chandra Kurt shares her top wine tips with us. We'll also get a recipe from no one else than Nigella Lawson, and we have a very nice dinner soundtrack recommendation. That is all ahead on this week's edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. One of the most impressive restaurant success stories in recent years has taken place in rural Sweden. Magnus Nilsson launched his restaurant Feviken Magasinet at a farm in Jämtland, some 600 kilometers north from Stockholm, and in a relatively short time the place became one of the world's most in-demand eateries, guests flying from thousands of miles away to get to taste Magnus's unique dishes and to stay overnight at the farm. With two Michelin stars at the peak of its success, it was suddenly announced that Feviken would close, and the final serving was indeed at the end of last year. The story's not over yet, though. Magnus Nilsson has just released his new book, Feviken 4015 Days Beginning to End, where he shares the restaurant's story and the lessons he learned over the years. Magnus joined me on the line from Sweden to tell me more, and the first question he answered was the most burning one. Why did he decide to close Feviken?
I mean, for me, I think it was just because it was simply finished, you know, as a project. And I know that this is something that a lot of people are going to find a little bit odd, because Feviken was a very well-functioning, you know, organization, business. It was fully booked every day. I know that that's so much more than a lot of other restaurants can ever even hope for. But to me, having spent 12 years there, it was just done. You know, I was finished with it. And I even tried to tell myself that I should keep it open a little bit longer, because it is like a really good, well-functioning restaurant. You know, I can let my team run it for me and sort of phase myself out. But I didn't feel good doing that in the end. So the only real option was to close.
The name of this new book is Feviken, 4015 Days Beginning to End, and I was wondering, when you were writing this, was it a moment of reflection, what you had done over the years, and was there something about Feviken you realized when you were working on this book?
So the book has, from when it was commissioned and decided to be produced and written until it was actually finished, it's gone through a lot of different stages of what it was. Initially, it was intended to just be little, you know, narrative essays about my time at Feviken and some reflections on that. But, you know, it wasn't supposed to even contain any dishes or recipes. And in the end, I actually included the full list of every single dish ever served at the restaurant and recipes for a lot of them as well. And I realized that the recipes are like the perfect backbone of a story for a restaurant with a limited lifespan, you know? If you use them to kind of support the ongoing narrative about the restaurant. And one of the things that made me want to include them in the first place was that so many people asked and so many people told me about when, like, the news was out that we were going to close and all that. So many people told me about experiences they've had at Feviken and that weren't necessarily about the food, but they were always connected to like a memory of a specific dish. And that made me think that this was like such an interesting phenomena that I wanted to include all of them.
Tell me more about that. I'm looking at the list of these recipes. Tell me more about how you think these recipes reflect the lifespan of Feviken and how, you know, the story has a beginning and it has an end. The first recipe on this list is a roasted marrow bone of moose, diced of raw moose heart, thinly cut cabbage, toasts and herb salt. And the final one from the year 2019 in this list is grilled cardoon, fermented berries and oat sauce.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with the restaurant as a creative expression, the food as a creative expression, is that it will be evolving. And Feviken was constantly evolving from beginning to end. And I think that by including this long list of all of the dishes that we ever served in the restaurant and all of the variations of them, you can really look at that and you can follow the development of the restaurant and perhaps also to some extent of me as a creative individual. I did that as sort of the backbone of the story of the restaurant, and then I inserted these longer narrative texts and introductions to the recipes amid the recipes and the chronological flow of them.
How do you feel like you changed as a chef over the course of over 10 years?
Well, I'm 12 years older now. Like, that's the first thing. And I think that it's 12 years of additional experience of seeing things, feeling things, tasting things, meeting people, changing perspectives and so on. And, you know, I've never been of the persuasion that you should go out looking specifically for a certain type of inspiration, for example. I don't think that that's like how creativity actually works. And when you do that, it's more something that resembles problem solving to me. But I do think that when you're living life as a creative person, you also need to be very open to have experiences, to kind of try to get past your biases and like really, really see things for what they are, experience things for what they are. And obviously in 12 years, you do get to see a lot of stuff and it will, you know, influence the creative outcome of a restaurant. And to me, I don't have any like deeper reflection on specifically what changed, except that it did change. And that was very apparent for me and I think for everyone that ate there as well.
I'm wondering, all the things you saw at Fevik and over the course of 12 years, do you have any anecdotes, any special evenings you remember particularly fondly or you just happen to remember for various reasons?
I think that the very last days are the ones that sort of come to mind. And I think it's especially relevant now when we're in the midst of the pandemic, you know, with all of the consequences for social life that that has had and the consequences for restaurants and other businesses as well, is that I got to choose the end for my business. And that's a huge privilege. And to me, that was very, very important. And the end that I chose was essentially an end that celebrated the people that had been closest to the restaurant. So essentially the whole last week the restaurant was open was just people that came back for a last meal, you know, people that had meant a lot to me and the team for some reason. And then the very last day, we didn't have any service. It was essentially just a big party. And I think that most of those like parties where you celebrate like an anniversary in your restaurant or another business or when you're closing, I think you think about this as a restaurateur very strategically and you invite a certain group of people because you want to benefit from it. But this time around for us, it felt important for me and for the owners of Fabiken that this party, like the last day that Fabiken existed as a restaurant, was only for the staff. So essentially we invited every single person that had ever worked at Fabiken. And I think that everyone but 7 people or something came. So we were 200 or something people and we had like beautiful giant party together, which was a real celebration of the commitment of this group to doing something exceptional in a really cool place.
I'm wondering, when you've been in charge of a restaurant like Fevik and you have the last day, you have the last meal over there, how did you decide what to offer? What was on the menu?
On the very last day when we had the big party, I essentially asked some of the people that were going to come to the party what they wanted to have. And then we asked those restaurants to come and cook for us. So there were a few of our mutual favorite restaurants came and cooked for the old team at Fabiken. So we didn't have to cook ourselves.
Now, we talked about this list of all the dishes served at Fabiken already, but I'm wondering, what are the dishes you are most proud of?
I don't know. Like when I sit and think about it now, I don't feel very much at all when I think about like the old dishes. It kind of just blurs together a little bit. I'm much more proud than of any specific dish. I'm much more proud of the kind of evolution of the restaurant from beginning to end. It might sound a little bit weird, but I mean, it's just about 1 year since we closed. And yeah, it feels like the dishes are a thing of the past. Yeah, I don't feel very much for them anymore.
I think it's obviously astonishing what you did with Fevikken, and I'm wondering about the beginning. How did you turn it into one of the world's most famous restaurants? Basically, what I'm asking is, what was your approach? How did you spread the message? How did you turn one of the world's best restaurants also into one of the world's most famous restaurants?
I think to get that out of the way already from the beginning, there is an element of luck in timing when it comes to these things, that there is an opportunity and a need for something that someone has to offer and the world happens to be receptive at that moment. And I think that applies to us to some degree. But I also do think that if you're doing something that you truly, truly care about and you're really good at doing it and you're also good at conveying that feeling to whoever comes, it's something that is a human thing. You know, people respond to that. I mean, that was one of the reasons why I, in the end, wrote the book as well, is that I realized that Savikin was so much more than a restaurant to so many people, not just to me. And I think that was the kind of the key to getting that message across to essentially the whole world, was that there was just so many people that felt strongly about Savikin. And then, as I said in the beginning, I mean, there's always a certain amount of luck involved when it comes to the timing of things. For example, like if you look at the practicality of this, there were some pivotal moments when we produced TV documentaries. One was the Chef Table with Netflix, and the other one was The Mind of a Chef for public television in the US. And like, as a practical tool, obviously, that was hugely, hugely important for the spread of this sort of message from our side. But that would never have happened if it hadn't been the right moment for us to do it, I think.
Exactly, and what you've done with Fevikan, for example, over the years has been pioneering work in so many levels. I'm wondering, how do you continue that work? What else are we going to be seeing from Magnus Nilsson in the future?
That's a good question. I mean, a lot of people ask if I'm going to run another restaurant, and the answer to that is I don't know. I mean, I'm not fed up with running restaurants, but I was finished running Fevikan. And I also don't feel at the moment a huge excitement about starting something new, which is the reason I haven't. And I don't have any plans of doing it either at the moment. Right now, I'm working with the MAD Foundation, which was started by René Redzepi of NOMA 11 years ago. And we're working on a project where we are essentially developing a school for people working in hospitality to just be better. And not necessarily at cooking, but, you know, we want them to be better equipped to make good choices around leadership and business and environment and sustainability. That's sort of my main focus right now. And if I one day wake up in the morning and feel the same burning desire to run a restaurant again that I used to feel with Fevikan, I won't hesitate for a moment. I will just open again. But until that day, I will continue doing other things.
Magnus, how often do you get phone calls from, not only in Sweden, but from abroad as well, from wealthy companies who would like to do something with you in the restaurant front?
I mean, it happens, but it's not so easy to find me, you know. I don't have a website, and difficult to find my phone number and so on. So, and that's on purpose. You know, I don't, especially now this first year since I closed, I really closed all of those communication channels as well, because I felt like I wasn't open for business or proposals for business. I'm not interested in that at the moment. I just want to do what I've chosen to do and put a little bit of time between the closure of, you know, a 12-year chapter of my life and, you know, thinking on my own, essentially.
It sounds like you're in a very good place in life. Well, obviously, as you mentioned already, when we're doing this interview, we're in the middle of the pandemic and lockdown in many parts of the world as well. I'm wondering, looking into the future, what would be your top tips when things get better, how to throw a great party?
That would have been my top tip, actually, to wait until it gets better. Don't throw the party right now. I mean, for me, I like dinner parties a lot, and I like having friends over. And, you know, I think that's like one of the reasons why I ran the restaurant for so many years and why I got into hospitality in the first place, is I really do like having people over. And I think that it doesn't have to be so complicated, you know. Just like my favorite thing to do is actually everyone that comes do something, participate. Like they bring something with them to eat. They bring a bottle of wine, and you don't have to make it into a very complicated thing. I find it often that when there is a special moment that someone wants to celebrate, and they try to kind of also make the party signal that, they usually end up having a less good party and a less good time than, you know, if they just focused on the people coming and them having a good time together.
Swedish top chef Magnus Nilsson there, and his book Fevikan 4015 Days Beginning to End is out now. You are with The Menu on Monocle 24. Up next, it's time for this week's food and drink news. Here is Monocle's Charlie Filmacourt.
Thanks, Marcus. First, it's off to Beijing, where this week Michelin unveiled their 2021 guide for the city, revealing with it the latest proud recipients of the coveted Michelin star. King's Joy, a vegetarian restaurant run by chef Gary Yin, was the biggest winner, receiving 3 stars and making it one of only 2 restaurants in the city to boast such an accolade. It was also the recipient of the country's first ever Michelin Green Star, a distinction that recognises restaurants that are at the forefront of a more sustainable approach to gastronomy. In the guide, there was also one new two-star edition, as well as seven restaurants that earned their first stars. Next, it's to New York, where famed Parisian tea room Angelina opened its first US location this week. Located on 6th Avenue near Bryant Park, the interiors resemble Belle Époque Paris in an ode to the original, which was built in 1903 on the French capital's Rue de Rivoli. New Yorkers will be able to sample the classic menu items, including its famed hot chocolate and the Mont Blanc pastry made with French meringue and chestnut vermicelli. A short hop now to St. Moritz, where the legendary Culm Hotel is welcoming Mauro Colagreco to take over the K restaurant this winter. The Argentinian-Italian chef is best known for his Mirazor restaurant in Monton, which achieved 3 Michelin stars last year and was named as number one restaurant in the world's 50 best restaurants list. And finally, to London, where the hospitality sector is joining forces for the Save Nightclubs campaign. Due to COVID-19 enforced closures, recent surveys show that 58% of nightclubs will go out of business within a month, a number that could rise to 81% by Christmas. With a value to the UK's economy of over £3 billion and a huge cultural value on top of that, it's a vital industry that needs help. To give your support, head to savenightclubs.com. That's all from me this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Charlie. This is the menu on Monocle 24. As the evenings have got dark and the festive season is not that far away anymore, it's time to get some good tips for choosing the right wines. And that's why we are now getting connected to Monocle's Zurich Bureau. I'm joined by one of Monocle's friends, Chandra Kurt, who is an author and editor of Wine Cellar Journal. Hello, Chandra.
Hello, Marcus.
It's so nice to have you join us in the programme. Chandra, this year, 2020... obviously won't be easily forgotten for obvious reasons, but I'm wondering, what do you think? What kind of a year has it been for wines?
Well, let's say it was actually, you know, of course you have two sides of it, but it's a good year for wines because people cooked more at home, enjoyed wine more at home, and maybe with more awareness because it was a difficult year. So everything you did more emotional. And for the wine, I think it had a positive impact.
Now, could you tell me about some wines you have discovered recently that have got you particularly excited?
Well, the funny thing is that usually, you know, in the springtime, there is this big wine fairs and everybody comes together and you get all the new wines presented. And this didn't happen this year. So a lot of things came online or even you waited. Some wines weren't launched. But there was one wine that I got the opportunity to taste, and it's one of the most exclusive and new launches that exist. It's the Massettino. It's the second wine of Massetto. And Massetto is like one of these fine wine, blue chips wine that, you know, you dream to buy one because you don't get it or it's too expensive. And they launched the second wine, so an introductory wine, of course, on a high level. And I got the opportunity, you know, to taste it. And I must say, it really touched me because it was such a perfection and the pure energy in this difficult year that you found a wine that really boosts you to see positive.
That sounds so good. I'm wondering anything else you have come across recently?
Something that I always come back to it, and it's a Swiss wine. It's the Chardonnay from Daniel and Marta Gantenbein. So it's from the Grison, the Bündner Herrschaft. It's a Chardonnay this is full of seduction and creaminess and power, but also gentle aromas. And it's a wine that exists for many years. But when I have the opportunity to taste it, it gives me this pleasure that over and over again. And I'm very grateful for that.
I'm wondering, when it comes to the vintage of the year 2020, you know, if we want to buy something already, what should we go for?
Well, you know, it's still young. It depends where you buy from, but the vintage was actually good. It's, you know, people also had more time, they took more care. So it's not a bad vintage. You can go for the white wines and then drink them also early already. In Switzerland, for example, for also Riesling Silvaner from the lake areas. So it is also a vintage you will not forget. So I suggest strongly to buy some, you know, put aside and think about this special year.
I think it's interesting you mentioned a moment ago, by the way, before we continue with more recommendations about how this year has been very strange in the business, considering that you haven't had those wine fairs and so many things have been going on online. How has that changed and affected the industry?
Well, very strongly, because, you know, suddenly everything happens online. And also, for example, tasting sets are sent out different. You get little bottles ready with a tasting mat. Then everybody is on Zoom or on Skype and you taste together. Naturally, it's not the same because, you know, the real emotion is missing. You hear maybe in one each other, but you don't smell and it's different. But still, you know, we start to taste online together.
Now, Chandra, the evenings have got cold and dark in the Northern Hemisphere, and I'm wondering, for some comfort, what kind of wines would you recommend for us who actually just want to, you know, maybe have a hot bath, just relax at home and try to relax and forget about any stress?
Yeah, well, this is always good. But the good thing about that it's darker now, it's usually when the light goes away, you know, you drink more easily. You don't think, oh, it's still sunshine, I have to be careful, it's too warm. So the darker it gets, the more the bottles get open. And also you maybe drink a little bit heavier wines because you think it's cold. I can say for myself, I love to go back to the classics, you know, the classics wine from the classic wine region. And one of them is in Spain, and I think it's really the time now to drink sherry. Sherry you can drink in the bath, in front of a candle, in front of the chimney, while reading a book. It has a little bit higher alcohol, but you drink it slower, so it goes together. This oxidized sherry style, maybe an Oloroso style. And if we want something from Switzerland here, you know, we do a lot of very nice wines. I love very much, it's a white wine now, it's the Haida, it's our indigenous grape, which grows till almost 150 meters. So it's an alpine white wine. It's a rarity. It reminds of the force of the Alps. And it's the family of the Traminer. And in the Jura, for example, they do this oxidized vin jaune that goes again back to the sherry. So it's in a way the fresh version of the sherry and just another example of it.
And you don't need to drink that as slowly as the sherry.
No, actually there you have to be careful because while you drink it, you don't feel it. And there's old poetry about it that say that, you know, when you stand up, your legs are all like gummies and you don't know how to walk after. So, you know, be careful.
That sounds so good. Well, Chandra, I guess it's not too early now to look a bit further either. Let's talk about Christmas season and Christmas itself. What would you recommend?
Well, of course, I will recommend not to, let's say, not put aside things. It's really the time of the year. Open the bottles. Don't be shy. You know, it's really you have maybe friends or maybe not so many, just family. You cook everything. The whole day is about eating and drinking. But I have always some basic tips before I tell you some concrete wine examples. You need more than one style of wine because in an evening, you know, not everybody loves red or white or sparkling. So I will open the whole battery from all styles. And then you always need to drink as much water as you drink wine, you know, really, because the days can be long, the evenings can be long. So drink a lot of water and you will feel better the next day. And one thing which is also important, maybe you always have a story about the wine. Why did you choose this one? And while having a story, you will see the wine taste immediately better after. But then if we go concrete into wines to recommend, bubbles are always good. I love very much zero dosage, so meaning they are very dry, so the palate gets activated for dinner after. And you can take them from all over. I like very much the Franciacorta region from northern Italy. And in Switzerland, for example, we have this famous from the Neuchâtel area family, Moller. They do all kinds of nice bubbles. And rosé is, even if you will say it's a summer wine, there are a lot of dishes that go well with rosé because it's like a passepartout wine. You can serve it with all kinds of tastes of flavors from spicy to not spicy. And then if it comes to white, I think, you know, really a Chablis and a Sancerre, of course, you are always happy. And from Switzerland, again, you get to the Haida or the Petit Arvigne, our older alpine indigenous grape, and the guests will be happy. And with red wine, something that everybody will love, or it's not too heavy, then you go for Pinot Noir from all over, or you go really for the wines that push you in the chair and you hardly can stand up, which are this Amarone style wine that have 15 alcohols, and of course you can say port wine style, but you can play among these two ligas.
Some really useful recommendations there. And now, Chandra, now that we have you there, I guess we should ask about the New Year celebrations as well. What do you drink normally?
Well, I really drink bubbles. I think I drink anyway the whole year bubbles. I think it's you have to give you some sparkle in the life. But New Year is really the evening where you can let the corks fly and close the year and hope that the next year is going to be at least as good as the year before.
I agree with that. Now, finally, Chandra, before we let you go, obviously hosting parties, is out of question in many countries at the moment, but things are going to get better eventually. So for when we can finally get together again, I'm wondering, what are your top party tips?
Not just to open one bottle, you know, have different bottles ready because you have different guests and they have different tastes. And don't have just one bottle ready because maybe one is the favorite and then you don't have enough. And for example, why not to open magnum bottles, like it's the double size of a normal wine bottle. And something I always love to do is to fill my bus tube with a lot of ice and water and put every, you know, every guest can also bring a bottle and put it inside. And then you go fishing out of your bus top to find some bottles.
That sounds so good. Chandra Kurt there, thank you very much. And we'll speak to you soon again. Let's now continue with a top recipe tip for this week. This time we hear from one of Britain's most beloved culinary figures.
I'm Nigella Lawson, and I have a recipe for you that I eat such a lot. I'm not going to give you weights and measurements because it's not that kind of recipe. It's a riff on the very basic Italian recipe of spaghetti with garlic and chili and olive oil. So I'm cooking my spaghetti in one pan, lots of boiling salted water. And while the spaghetti is cooking, I put some olive oil in a pan over not too high a heat. And I add quite a few, but you can start modestly, anchovy fillets. And I stir them into the pan and they seem to dissolve into the oil. When they have all but melted into the oil, I add quite a lot of minced garlic. Well, I grate it very finely, but you could chop it. You could slice it as well. Put that in, then a bit of finely grated lemon zest and a few dried chili flakes. And when the spaghetti is ready, make sure if you're going to drain it, keep some of the pasta cooking water first. But otherwise, just lift it out with tongs and put it into the pan of garlic and anchovy and lemon zest and chili. And then toss it into the pan. Add as much of the wonderfully starchy water as you want to help the sauce emulsify. And then toss through. You can either do some chopped fresh parsley or some chopped chives, you know, whatever you want, and perhaps drizzle a bit of extra virgin olive oil on it before you eat. And it's full of flavour and oomph, but comforting at the same time.
Thanks to Nigella Lawson for her recipe. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. For previous episodes of this programme, go to Monocle's website, SoundCloud or Apple Podcasts. And remember to subscribe to the show so that it automatically arrives onto your device every week. Also, do check out our Menu spin-off show, Food Neighbourhoods, for more great recipes. This show was edited and mixed by David Stevens and I am Markus Hippi. Once again, we finish this programme with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here is Jeans for Jesus with Europe. Thanks for listening. Alleluia,